The case for argument this morning is Sheehy Enterprises against the National Labor Relations Board.
Good morning, Your Honor. And
call your name when the case is ready to be argued.
Okay.
We generally allow both lawyers to find seats at counsel table.
Okay.
Mr. Mills.
Yes, may it please the court. I'm Bruce Mills, and I represent Sheehy Enterprises. And I want to spend a moment talking about the history of this, because I think there's two major issues that I can talk about this morning. One has to do with the 10B issue or waiver issue, because this is extended on forever. But how this case got here began with Mr. Sheehy, whose employees were not represented, was working on a job in which the general contractor was a signatory to the laborers. The laborers came and said, "You need to be a signatory to work on this project." He said, "Okay." He understood that, rightly or wrongly, that meant for that project only. So he paid the union trust funds and everything during that project. After that project, he ceased doing so and heard nothing from the union. The first contract he signed was 2003, October 13th, and he heard nothing from them until May of 2004, and at that time he was working on another job in which the contractor was a signatory, and the union came out and said, "You need to sign a new contract," and did not mention anything at all about anything in arrears. And he assumed then, because they hadn't contacted him, that this was a project-only agreement, as was his prior assumption. So he paid the union trust fund dues, et cetera, for that project, and then ceased doing so. That was in 2004, and heard nothing from them until this unfair labor practice was charged in 2008.
It's a practical matter. In this kind of operation as a non-union subcontractor, I assume any time you put in a bid when you know the contractor is union, that this isn't this par for the course, that you've got everybody's got to be a member? Or isn't that common in the industry, or doesn't everybody know that?
No, Mr. Sheehy didn't know that. And plus, knowing whether or not the general contractor is a signatory, actually it falls upon him or her to make sure that all the subcontractors are signatories also, because that's where it triggered. If he wasn't a signatory, then this sort of thing wouldn't have happened.
Well, I can understand the argument. Nobody likes to be blindsided, but it seems to me once somebody gets whacked, you're going to look a little closer the next time. I don't know.
Nothing happened in between the first contract and the second contract. He heard nothing from the union.
Yeah, well, I assume that's because he wasn't doing any other union work.
Well, the contract doesn't cover just union work. It covers all work.
I know. But they don't monitor it unless it's their guy, I guess.
There are court decisions that say that simply their laxness, which was the term the ALJ said, isn't an excuse. They knew or should have known within a reasonable time after they heard nothing from Mr. Sheehy.
Well, he didn't read the contract, which is part of the problem, isn't it?
It is. That being aside, and then on January 24th, 2008,
Counsel, your time is short.
I know. So let me. There's the two big issues. One is the issue of timeliness, and that's based on a course called A&L Underground.
Was timeliness raised before the board?
Pardon?
Was the timeliness question raised before the board?
As a waiver, yes, they waived their right before the ALJ, and the 10B was raised before the board also. And
I don't understand what as a waiver means.
Well,
could you just describe how the timeliness issue was raised?
In the my predecessor on the case, when he wrote the brief, post-hearing brief, he said in there that this should be overturned, that the decision should go for Mr. Shahi because they waived their right to take action because it's been 5 years. At this time, it had been 5 years since the original contract was signed. It had been nearly 3.5 years since the second contract was signed. They simply sat on their hands. And so their inaction.
I'm lost. That doesn't have anything to do with the timeliness of the charge of discrimination. Was an argument made about the actual period of limitations in the statute? Right? There's no equitable estoppel concept here.
There was before the board. One of the exceptions they took before the board is this should be overturned because they did not meet the requirements of 10B, which is 6 months.
That's pretty much after the fact, though, isn't it? I mean, they get around to it pretty late.
It is. Now, one of the problems here is that, you know, the way this is supposed to work is that Region 25 investigates the charge to determine whether or not there are probable cause. On the face of the complaint they issued, they said, one, this is a 9A contract, and two, this met the requirements of 10B. They were both dead wrong. And so the case that was litigated by my predecessor made those two assumptions, and he shows up at the hearing and, oh, by the way, we're changing this. This is really an 8F contract, and they didn't say anything about 10B, and so he didn't argue that until he argued timeliness in his post-hearing brief, saying this had gone on too long. So that is there. And, you know, in terms of timeliness, A&L Underground says this is not a continuing violation, that it begins when the union gets notice that the company is not complying with the contract, and if this doesn't require the union to go search them out, if they don't get any trust fund paperwork or whatever, they should have known within a couple of months. There's no one that's given a specific time. And this went on first time for 5 years, the second time for 3.5 years.
So puzzle what this has to do with the statute of limitations. If you borrow money from a bank and it requires you to make a payment every month, and you don't pay in January, and you don't pay again in February, and you don't pay again, right, is it your position that the statute of limitations expires, say, 6 months after the first nonpayment, and that therefore future nonpayments can't be litigated?
There are cases that I have cited that says after 6 months, that, you know, beginning with A&L Underground, and then there's an Eighth Circuit case, Durham Drywall, that hasn't come up before.
Yeah, but have you looked at the Supreme Court cases? This issue came up in a case called NAVCO. And the Supreme Court said that a dispute of that kind was timely if it was begun within the statute of limitations of any missed payment.
This did
Which
not.
Which means that this would be timely if it was begun within 6 months after the last non-payment.
This is not considered. There is case law that I cited in my brief that
but
this is.
Between the Supreme Court and a 30-year-old decision of the Eighth Circuit, which one are we going to follow?
Again, I'm going to say that there are several cases which say this is not a continuing violation. The second issue goes to the basis, and I see my time is short, of DECLA. And someone earlier made the comment that the NLR, that the IR, that the court doesn't have the right to amend the IRS statutes. The NLRB and DECLA amended the National Labor Relations Act. For one thing, it says that It's only for employees that are representatives. This court, the Supreme Court, says in an 8F agreement, the union is not the representative of the employees. They have to be voted in. And so there's that one thing. Section 885, which the board found that Mr. Sheehy violated, says that this only applies to Section 9A contracts. This was not a 9A contract. They amended it in declaration to say, by the way, we're going to make this 8F also. But,
well, it's just the building trades, right?
Yes, it's construction. It says a 9A contract. Several building trades recently have been converting to 9A contracts. But it doesn't say that. They've turned the NLRA on its ear. Plus the fact that they had a contract with an arbitration clause in it, and they chose to ignore that and jump right to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court in April last year.
Thank you, Mr. Mills. Mr. Cohen.
May it please the Court. My name is Richard Cohen. I'm appearing on behalf of the Labor Board. Justice Holmes, with a friend of his from the Senate, was once heard to, when they were discussing their respective jobs, said, "My job is to play the game according to the rules." Neither Mr. Sheehy nor his attorneys have come close to that. The actual facts I just want to point out with respect to Mr. Sheehy's actual testimony about only the first contract that he signed was the only thing that he remembered the union saying to him, and the union testified to this, was in response to his inquiry, was that the contract you're signing won't apply to any other jobs you're working on or you have already bid other than the job that was signing you up, that you're signing this contract for. Mr. Fry testified that he understood it was clear that that meant that the agreement was to apply to all future jobs. We don't understand how that could be understood in any other terms. And Mr. Sheehy never tried to explain how he understood that to mean anything other than it would apply to future agreements.
So it is, it's just taking a hypothetical maybe, but in any job that they were working on right after this one, would the union have presumed that that was pre-bid and therefore not covered?
Well, no, Your Honor.
If it had, would that have been exempt under that, whatever you want to call
yes,
it?
Yes, certainly.
Okay.
You know, however, the agreement that he signed in October expired in March 2004, March 31st. Mr. Fry testified that the Union Benefit Fund routinely sends out a contract and a form and an acceptance form to all signatories to re-up, because without a signed agreement, there is no basis for the union funds to accept payments. And that is how Mr. Sheehy came to sign a second agreement, because he went to work on another project that had been bid by a union general contractor, and without being able to make benefit fund contributions, he signed a second agreement. His only excuse for allegedly misunderstanding, notwithstanding the fact that he's in the industry, and the union says it never, ever, ever agrees to anything other than what the contract says because it has a most favored nations clause. But his only basis for claiming that he didn't understand was a hope and a prayer, and his flagrant disregard to even read the agreement. And this court has said that's no excuse. Specifically, counsel disregards that The union didn't sit on its hands in the interim. The union had 2,200 contractors under contract within its geographic jurisdiction. At the time, it received reports concerning successful bids by general contractors, and it would police and go out and find out what was going on the projects that union general contractors bid. It had no way of following each and every subcontractor that was a signatory. It had, and in that brief window, was not what the union's, what the company's complaint was before the board. It only made three arguments before the board. The first argument was that Mr. Sheehy was snookered by the union, which was preposterous on his face and no excuse anyway. The second argument was that Mr. Sheehy told the union in 2004 that he wasn't going to follow the contract. The judge didn't believe him. And the third argument he made was, because the union had been told and did nothing, that it waived it. Didn't say that there was any 10B arguments, that it waived it. Waived its right to enforce the contract. Didn't argue Section 10B, but the predicate for any Section 10B argument that it belatedly made to the board was the same as its equitable argument, which the board rejected on its facts, credibility-wise, which ALJ did. And the other argument was this argument about DECLA, which this court has already rejected. Now, there have been a whole bunch of other arguments that have been advanced on appeal. None of them were made before the board, and they're not properly before the court. Counsel tries to couch them in terms of jurisdiction, going to the board's jurisdiction. They don't. In order to demonstrate that, we had to get somewhat into the merits of it, but cursorily. The statute, the National Labor Relations Act, gives the board jurisdiction to decide contract termination cases. It says so in Section 8D, which defines the duty to bargain. The board has always decided contract termination cases that go to the very heart of the act, the very heart of the duty to bargain. That's what this case involved. The statute says that the board's jurisdiction won't be affected by any other means of resolution. The board has a deferral policy. When it announced that perspective,
well, generally it has jurisdiction over unfair labor practices.
Right.
That's the general.
And if they involve contract questions, as this one does, but we submit it wasn't really much of a question at all. It was predicated on an argument that had no facts to support it, based upon Mr. Sheehy's own testimony. And they keep on moving the fences and changing the facts. They assert the headings in their arguments before the judge and the board was simply not supported by anything in the record. The union didn't mislead Mr. Sheehy one bit. In their brief to the court, they had suggested that the general contractor did. There's no evidence that the general contractor misled him. And even if it would be legally irrelevant. The man just needed to read the contract or ask the union. He did neither. The union had no inkling that he understood something that is not the practice of the union in Indiana, and the record is clear about that. So we think that the board's order should be enforced in full, unless the court has any further questions.
Mm-hmm.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.